Hi, everyone. The National Center for Education Statistics recently reported data that 74% of public schools had difficulty filling one or more vacant teaching positions, and that was at the start of the 24-25 academic year. It really hasn't changed. Nationwide teaching shortages are impactful for many schools, and we actually see impacts of that in very specific areas like STEM and also technical education. But of course, those shortages expand across other areas like special education and even down into the primary grade levels. In short, it's a problem that confronts every building in some way, shape, or fashion almost. Finding solutions to that problem, of course, is extremely difficult. However, there are some innovative districts that are taking advantage of technology solutions where they're using remote teachers and virtual classrooms. We will learn more about this approach in today's episode of Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUV Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Okay, thank you, Trinity. My guest today, and I'm excited to meet, Dr. David Lawrence. He's the superintendent of schools for Dayton City Schools, not exactly a sister city of Athens, Ohio, but certainly a place that in the state I visited several times. As an administrator, Dr. Lawrence has championed what he refers to as the five C's approach. We'll learn more about that in just a little bit. However, under his leadership, Dayton City Schools has also observed increases in academic achievement as well as reduced absenteeism, among other accolades. David, it's great to get to meet a fellow Ohioan on the podcast, and thanks for your time today.
Hey, Scott. Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Let's start by having listeners sort of learn about what Dayton is like as a city, and your district specifically is maybe not something that people would be familiar with unless they've driven through or something.
Dayton sits at the intersection of I-75 and I-70. Most major cities are not more than two and a half hours from here. Cleveland, 3 hours if you're driving fast. Columbus, an hour. Indianapolis, an hour and 15 minutes. Chicago, about 4.5. So the list of cities that are really close to us kind of goes on. Louisville, 2.5, Cincinnati, 1. So we're situated in a really unique place where you can get anywhere in 4 or 5 hours of driving from Dayton, Ohio. This is a city that used to be called the name of it is Gem City. Our nickname is Gem City. I mean, it tells you that this is a place that people thought was a gem. And it used to be called also the Silicon Valley of the Midwest before there was a real Silicon Valley out west. At that time, you had General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, all the subsidiary plants that make automotive parts. Also, what you had here was the second largest, well, at the time, it was the largest Air Force base in the world, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Bagram Air Force Base right now in Afghanistan is the largest, but as you your listeners may know, that was a recent construction during the our Middle East military explorations. So for a long time, the largest Wright-Patterson was the largest Air Force base. And then you had Standard Register, home of the cash register. Charles H. Kettering, there's a municipality right down south named Kettering, Ohio, where there's about 31,000 people. He lived there. He's the person who is the originator of the starter. The starter creates the whole process for having automated cars everywhere. So people think about Ford, General Motors, the Mellons, and they think about the major car manufacturers, but all of the manufacturers use starters. No starter, no cars. Mm-hmm. So all of those things were like started here. And of course, Dayton is the home of flight. I know North Carolina would dispute that, but this was an amazing place where late 1960s, when I was born, there were 70,000 kids in school here, approximately, and now we're down to 13. So mm-hmm. through globalization, through disindustrialization, through, a reality, white flight, people leaving the city and going to the suburbs, mm-hmm. The city is just a mirror or a fraction of what it used to be, but still a great place to be.
And, Dayton, the way you described it and the way I've experienced where it's situated in the state, it is very much, despite the fact that you've lost population, it's still very much an urban city, right?
Yes. It's an urban city with also, you know, we're hearing a lot about the possibility of SNAP ending. It's one of the poorest municipalities in the country, not in the state, in the country. There are places like Louisiana, Mississippi. The average income here and average home ownership, it mirrors those of some of the poorest places in the South.
So turning specifically to your district, approximately how many buildings do you have and what's your student population like?
Approximately 27 buildings. Student population is about 13,000. There's about 11 secondary schools. That means 7, 8, or 7 through 12, or 9 through 12. We have one alternative school, which is a specialty school. And we have about 16 elementaries and one preschool.
When I opened up the show and introduced you, I talked about the five C's, and I've read a little bit about that on your district website. But can you talk about what that means to you and sort of introduce that to listeners?
It's the core values of how we function and operate here in Dayton Public Schools. Almost all situations boil down to some derivative or some function of the five C's. And so we continuously work on culture. I want to have a culture of professionalism, I want to have a culture of collegiality, camaraderie, I want to have a culture of focusing on the work and making sure the main thing is the main thing, that's children. That seems very simple, but in most school systems, I'm telling you right now, it does not happen. People focus on territory, turf wars, they worry about what each other's salary is, the size of their office, all type of silly things. We try to make sure we don't get involved in any of that. So culture is really, really big for us. Customer service is big. Respond to emails, respond to phone calls, and know that each interaction for internal customer service and external customer service has something to do with our culture and how we want to be perceived. And then finally, I see the last three C's kind of together, which are collaboration, communication, and commitment. I will say this to you. When parents get upset with me and they send me emails, oftentimes, you have guiding principles like ours, the five C's. Every district, every organization has them. And when you go ask people about the guiding principles or core values, they typically can't tell you. Once you get past the top layer, you keep going, no one pays attention to it. Not here. When parents get upset with me, they'll send me an email and they'll say, Dr. Lawrence, there was a breakdown in communication. I hear that a lot. Or, Dr. Lawrence, where's your commitment with the children? You know, such and such and such happened. Or, hey, Dr. Lawrence. And so, and even internally, these things are referenced, the five C's. And so I've been around for a while now. And even when it's referenced in a way that could be kind of a shot at me, the superintendent, I accept it because it lets me know that the core values, whether it's in a good space or people are feeling kind of negative about it, there's something that people talk about.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. They might be the values that you represent and you know, take out and try to enculturate, but if they're talking about it, it means that they've heard that. That's a great lesson. You're obviously, you know, I've known you for 20 minutes or a little less. You're an ambassador of your city, and you're obviously very committed to the success of your students and your staff and your faculty. What got you into this? I mean, why did you become a teacher in the first place? How did you become an administrator?
Earlier, I heard you talking about Athens and some of your connections there. I attended UC and was a multi-sport athlete. I left UC and graduated from the Carl H. Linder School of Business and went out to work. One of my best friends was on the school board member. He was also in banking, and he thought it would be a good idea for me to become a math teacher. At the time, I didn't have any kids, or maybe I had one, I can't remember. And I really, I thought so too. It was a relatively, not significant, but it was a big pay increase, I mean decrease rather. But I enjoyed not teaching in the summer and preparing for the summer. I enjoyed being able to swim, run, hang out, camp, barbecue, fish. I enjoyed my schedule. I enjoyed being around kids during the school year. I enjoyed coaching. I coached multiple sports. And I thought to myself, this is a great transition career. You can retire after 30 years. They force you to to kind of put your money away through what we call state teacher retirement system. So even if you're not a good budgeter, they make sure you budget for yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
It kind of works out. And so I looked at all those, checked all the boxes, and I'm a pretty laid back, out of the way guy. And so this for me, you know, I don't need the world to survive. So I was really happy. Coaching, after school academic activities, teaching, 5 years at the middle school, 5 years at the high school level, middle school grades and high school grades. Mm-hmm. And I taught mathematics. And so I, this was made possible by a principal who, Dora Carson, who was my English teacher in high school. She was my high school principal, and she said, "Hey, I think you'd be a terrific administrator. I'll put you in this program and get your license and then see where it takes you." So I got my license and continued to teach. I never, again, didn't think about becoming a principal. And then a guy named Dr. Percy Mack, who's the superintendent at the time, gave me the opportunity to be an assistant principal for a year and then a high school principal. It usually takes you a long time to become a high school principal, but it's pretty rapid for me. Mm-hmm. And we were very successful at that high school, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So the topic that we are going to be talking about today, the focus of our discussion is really on this idea of, you know, having remote teachers working with your students. Before we talk about that specifically, though, you know, as a superintendent with the scope of the district that you described earlier, what have you personally witnessed in terms of this notion of a teacher shortage? How do you see that playing out in Dayton City Schools?
So I read about these things. Part of my job and just who I am is to continue to stay abreast of the latest research in education. And the New Teacher Project, TNTP, consistently suggests that we lose hundreds of thousands of teachers to resignation or retirement each year. You translate that from the national space, and then you ask yourself some local questions. The University of Dayton, one of the premier universities in, I think, the country, but certainly the state, they have a significant reduction in the number of candidates that are eligible as teachers. When I was a principal and teacher, we would take on dozens of UD interns. It's hard to find them now. Wright State University, which is another university very close, the same thing. Because I've been in this over two decades, closing in on three, I've been able to watch the number of available candidates dwindle. I talked to a gentleman named Brian Boyd, Dr. Brian Boyd. He's the chair of the education mathematics department at Wright State University. I called him and said, "Hey, listen, we need qualified 7 through 12 math and science teachers." He said, "Sure. I will give you an audience because of our relationship, David. We've known each other for a while. We've worked together closely, university and the district." I even left here, Dayton Public Schools, once. I left twice. I left one time to go work at Wright State to become the chief academic officer of their satellite school for education. So I've known him a while. And when I went to speak to the class, there were a grand total of nine candidates. Nine. So what that means is 16 school districts in the region, all fighting over nine candidates. I say that to say that, unfortunately, right now, at this point in history, it won't stay that way. But there aren't a lot of individuals who are going into teaching.
Yeah, yeah. My daughter, she's in her third year right now at a middle school just east of Athens. And, you know, we talk about it a lot because both my wife and I are, you know, obviously educators. And she's never once regretted it, but yet she looks back on it and said, if I didn't have parents that, you know, made getting my education possible because of us working at OU where she got her degree, that was a blessing, you know, for her because she was able to graduate with no debt. She looks at her peers that go through the teacher education program that are graduating with debt, and it's a really hard decision. Because you know what's facing you when you graduate, if you are, you know, coming out of school with $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 of student loans, that's a hard economic choice, you know. And there's a lot of other things that I think goes into that as well.
Scott, I want to say something about that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, I'm on a lot of podcasts. I do a lot of podcasts, a lot of interviews. I even have my own podcast, Scott. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And so I should say we. I mean, the people do it for me, yeah. But I'm just the host. But anyway,
I get it. We've got to have our people, right?
But right. But I didn't. A long time ago, when I came into education, because there wasn't a lot of the student debt associated with finishing, and even if there was, it seemed like your dollar, not it seemed, I know your dollar went further than it did today. Since 1973, we've seen a precipitous decline in what a dollar will buy you out in the open market. And so I say that to say that another function of this that I just now thought about, and I hadn't thought about it until you and I did this podcast now, is I'm watching teachers now after 2, 3, 4 years, of which I never would have thought about this, begin to think about, I want to be an administrator, or I want to work in, as a director of something. And you really don't have the knowledge, background base, and you don't have the acumen yet to train, teach, and coach other people.
Yeah.
But I now think it's a function of, hey, I'll make more money.
Yeah.
Not so much that I'm not committed to teaching, but this is not working for me in terms of taking care of myself. So I'll do something else in education where I make more money. So I watch people move more quickly to these jobs, and they're not nearly as ready. And it's destabilizing us in education and other spaces.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are you seeing specifically in Dayton, I mean, you used the example of math, but are there specific areas that are bigger pain points for you across your age groups or content areas?
You mentioned them all in your opening. Yeah. Math, science, and intervention specialists. Check the box. I just left the Chiefs of Change meeting, which is an amalgamation of 50 superintendents from around the nation. What I love about meeting with them is it's not really a conference, it's a community. Mm-hmm. We don't have lots of sessions where people are all over the place, speakers are everywhere, presenters are everywhere. It's one session with all of us all day long for 2 days. And what I heard from my peers from around the country, the 34 that were present in Orlando this Tuesday and Thursday, is the same issues I have. STEM, math, and intervention specialists. Spans a nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously you have to solve a problem, and that led you to make a decision to start utilizing remote teachers as a part of that solution. Thinking back on that, what, besides the fact that you just had to solve a problem, I mean, I get that. You maybe didn't have as many choices in front of you, but I'm sure you had to think through the idea of, you know, using remote teachers, people that are not in your building 24/7 as many teachers are, as we know. What were some of the things that you thought through, both yourself and your district, as you were making that decision to go down the road of using remote teachers with your students?
The first thing I thought about was there was a global event that changed the world for all of us, mm-hmm. and it was called the pandemic.
Yeah.
Well, prior to that, you saw graduate school classes typically where you could have virtual or synchronous and asynchronous learning at the collegiate level, right? Mm-hmm. It existed, but you were typically still in person. Post-pandemic, I began to read a lot of dissertations, too, around, well, what is the difference between virtual live interactions and interactions that are done through Zoom, Google Meet, and other platforms like that? And so what I found is that we now have reached an age where in certain spaces and places, you can insert virtual teaching or virtual communications as a baseline for moving an agenda, objective, or goals forward. Mm-hmm. I say baseline because I still think people matter. They matter even in communication. They matter in education. They matter in business. I said to you, I just finished meeting with those superintendents. We all got on planes and flew to Orlando, Florida. We could have done 2 days on Zoom. All the research says 4 or 5 hours max, and people are kind of zoomed out. We met in person for 8.5 hours for 2 days, shared lunch together, shared breakfast together. Went out that evening and hung out in town together. These are things that you can't get from Zoom. So I am not, or Google or some other medium. So I'm not anti, what do I call it? Anti-technology, but I do think some things are face-to-face, some things are remote, and some things are both. And so I thought that same thing about school, that if I can find a way to provide baseline knowledge acquisition for students in some of the most difficult subjects, that's one. Two, we know this to be a fact. Urban students who do not pass or have a strong algebra 1 base, they do not matriculate well in college. So I was setting up poor, white, and then black and brown kids to become failures if they chose to go to college by not having qualified math teachers in front of them. So we can't do that. And then the last thing is, I believe as an educator, we're also innovators. And what I mean by that is you pilot things. I would be disappointed if, I don't know about you, Scott, but I've reached a point in my life where, unfortunately, I have to go to the doctor for more things than I used to.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
I have to go more often than I used to. I used to go years and not have to go. What the heck, right? And so now I'm there, Scott, and invariably the physician walks in and they have two people with them, or one, and they're there. Intern or their resident or something of the nature, or I'll be asked to sign a paper to say would I be part of some type of study. It won't hurt you. We just need this information, and I always sign. And my point is, we're supposed to be innovators as educators, right? We're practitioners, much like people in medicine. People don't like to hear this, but we are practicing on children. We're practicing to try to understand if the curriculum that has been given to us is applicable, if the instructional delivery is sound, and do we see the results of it in an assessment? It is really that simple. We work in medicine too. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it was, let's try this and see what happens, because we clearly are not being successful with long-term subs with no background in math and science in front of our children.
Mm-hmm. As your students are experiencing working with remote teachers, the phrase when I was doing research on this that came up was virtual classrooms. Is that a term that you use commonly as you're talking about it? Does that have meaning for you?
Yes, but I would say that it has different meaning for different people based on where you are in the education spectrum. So the people who work closest to me, the chief academic officer, the chiefs of schools, the people who work at the highest level, virtual classroom is a term. But I would say we typically use the term Elevate K-12. That's the name of the company. Mm-hmm. So I hear that more than I hear virtual, but I hear both, but I hear Elevate K-12 more. That tells me you're talking about a virtual teacher.
Gotcha. When you started using Elevate K-12 as your provider and students are going into the classes, just so I understand it, because I actually was wondering about this, is it just Dayton students that a particular teacher is working with, or are there circumstances where you might have students from Dayton and students from California, et cetera, that are working with the same teacher in the same virtual classroom space?
Just Dayton students are being serviced by K-12.
When you onboarded this, were there any specific things that you had to do as a district from like a technology standpoint or a learning space standpoint to facilitate, you know, interactions with the remote teachers, with the students? You know, how did that look when you were sort of getting everything, the infrastructure ready to go for it?
So I mentioned this about 15 minutes ago about training and virtual interactions and research. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of research on how human beings respond in virtual environments. So Elevate K-12 in conjunction with our curriculum department put together training for the facilitators, because we have a facilitator in the classroom and then Elevate K-12 has a teacher. So the kids, students, children are not left in the room to their own devices. There's an adult there to make sure they stay on task. So training for all adults that on our end that are going to be involved in the classroom. Elevate K-12 already does their own training.
Do the Elevate K-12 experiences, are they approximately the same size of experience that a student would have if they were in a non-virtual classroom?
When you said same size, could you
clarify? Yeah, like, I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear on that. Let me rephrase, just wholly rephrase the question. A lot of times, like in higher ed, when we're talking about doing remote classes, synchronous or asynchronous, there's always the question of how many students do you put in that section? Is it the same number that you would put in a section that was being taught by one of my faculty in person? And that's always an open debate, you know, and I always kind of come down on the fact that, you know, if you've got a subject where you think that the best pedagogy is to teach 20 students, that shouldn't change because it's virtual one way or the other on that. But that's always a debate that people have. And so that was long-winded, but what do your section sizes or class sizes look like for students that are in these virtual classrooms?
I thought that's what you meant. I wanted to just make sure. And we call them sections too, schedule high schools. And we kind of come down on the same side as Scott. If there were 18 kids scheduled to be in this chemics or physics class, an AP physics, then so be it. Mm-hmm. If there were 27 scheduled to be in ELA 12, and then that's where we are. Mm-hmm. So we didn't change our section size based on our virtual / Elevate K-12 teachers.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking about the five C's, you started with culture and, spoke, very passionately about the importance of culture. As you look at the way that students are, in the virtual classrooms working with the remote teachers, how does that play out in terms of the culture of those classrooms and the way that those teachers that, could be teaching from anywhere in the world, literally integrate with your students in that learning experience?
The students receive the teachers as something different, something new. They're in a virtual space. And because they're not directly in front of them, I notice the interactions to be somewhat, what's the word I want to use? They're very respectful. And I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to. It almost feels like because that person is not there, the students in some cases, many cases, appear to be more attentive. Now, we do have a facilitator that has to go around and say, hey, you are not supposed to be looking at your fantasy football team, right? Get off that side and move to this one, or transition from this side and move to this one. But by and large, I think it's because you're engaged with your own one-to-one technology. You're engaged with the screen. You have a virtual curriculum and or a book with you as well. Mm-hmm. I think it fits the kinesthetic needs of this generation of students because lots of things are going on. And they seem to be engaged in the process. I shouldn't say a list, but when I go into high schools, I typically say, and I know by now, but in the beginning of the year, because we have a different mix of classes every year. We have about 15 virtual classrooms now. It's a different 15 not a completely different 15 than last year. Maybe 12 are different, 3 or 4 are the same. But I go in and ask, hey, where are the virtual classrooms? I usually stop in and sit down and do a little work, especially if it's a math classroom. I participate as a facilitator just to see how things are going.
I've got some virtual faculty that, teach courses in my curriculum, and I've gotten to know them a little bit because they were actually the ones that are long-term employees of ours, were actually graduates of our program that moved away and wanted to, continue to be engaged with us. And they all have interesting stories about why they chose to do that. Like I've got a couple PhD students that, got their doctorates and literally could have taught anywhere that they wanted to, and they chose to teach for us virtually, and that's been their career. I mean, they're still relatively young, but I mean, they've been doing it for a decade now. Their stories are always really interesting. Have you met some of the virtual teachers where you're just like, I totally get why you're doing this, teaching virtually in your career right now? Have you met some of them and have any stories like that?
I totally get it. This is my 29th or 30th year. I want to do about 5 more. And when I'm done, I want to teach virtually.
Yeah.
I totally get it. A lot of the teachers that are teaching for Elevate K-12 that we have, they were very successful in their career. The face-to-face teaching had run its course. 2 or 3 Elevate classrooms per day. If those blocks or sections in the morning, you have your afternoons to yourself. With technology, we've moved to be able to rapidly give feedback for assessments much faster than we could before. I mean, Elevate K-12 or virtual teaching in general is not a bad gig at all.
Yeah.
I hear some of that when I talk to the teachers as I'm waiting on class transition or if I get there early. And for me, as a former teacher and someone who's getting close to retirement, it makes all the sense in the world. Who knows? You might see my application come across your desk.
There you go. We're always looking for public speaking teachers, and I'll bet you could do that. So I'll hold you to it if you want a gig. One of the things that teachers experience is the relationship that they have with their principal, and oftentimes that means that they're getting observed by their principal and getting feedback on how to progress. And in many, if not most of those cases, the teachers really grow as a result of that. For the teachers that are teaching virtually for you, is there an element of observation and assessment that is akin to what the face-to-face teachers do?
Yes. Elevate K-12, when they're in, they have their own kind of virtual spotters where they pop in and give feedback. And then our expectation is that our principals will have a set schedule to be able to follow up on virtual teaching and give feedback. And then my expectation is, you hear me talking from me all the way down to the principal level, assistant principal level. The idea is that we'll dedicate some time to give some feedback and have a concrete, learned discussion on what our virtual teaching looks like, sounds like, and feels like. And just so happens last year in Baltimore and Henderson, Nevada, I gave a couple of presentations. And in our first year, the virtual teachers outperformed the certified teachers. Algebra 1, geometry, and a few other subject areas. So that is not something I want to go broadcast to the teacher union president.
Yeah.
But it is, it is some data we have.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess the last question I've got for you, you mentioned a few minutes ago that the virtual classrooms are something that I think your phrase was it fit kinesthetically, the needs of the students right now. And I think I know what you mean by that. As you think forward, I'm doing the same thing myself. As you think forward about the ways that sort of our students are just using technology, experiencing it, the ways that pressure is being put on all of our, physical, day-to-day practices in K-12 and higher education. What do you think education is going to look like in 20 years, when we have AI continuing to do what it's doing, we have technology that, literally travels with us everywhere we go? What do you think it's going to look like? Do you have thoughts on that?
I do. This is 2025, and if you look at a classroom from 1925, that's 100 years ago, the classrooms still look relatively similar at the secondary level. Mm-hmm. There are rows of desks, and there are students sitting in them, and there's a teacher in front of them. Mm-hmm. What's changed is the students now all have their own one-to-one technology. They can access curriculum electronically or remotely or from files or for databases. The teacher now, instead of chalk, has a whiteboard that's interactive in which he or she can connect with the one-to-one devices. And then you mentioned artificial intelligence as one of the new components that we're dealing with now, and not just education, in life.
Yeah.
So what I see is I see that, because it seems like in education, it's really hard to get away from the structural component of what it is, but some of the accoutrements around it change. Just as I mentioned now, the changes from 1925 to now. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I see a scenario in which the technology around kids may change and around teachers may change. But I think some of the basic foundations of how schools are structured will stay the same. It would take a massive public works reorganization of assets and resources to remodel and relook at how schools are built and how kids are sitting, standing, or how they interact with each other. In an ideal world, you'd have some carpet spaces, you'd have some stand-up desks, spaces that were cut into a wall, you'd have a mini library, a outdoor space right outside of each classroom, which was a learning lab. Hmm. I mean, if you had enough money, you could create these really genius spaces. We actually, my first year on the job, presented in Columbus on what a dream library would look like, and it looked nothing like the libraries that you see now. Mm-hmm. But that was a dream, let's be clear. It cost a lot of money. We have something called the Ohio Schools Facility Commission. I don't think they're interested in spending billions to change the structure of how schools look for Dr. David Lawrence.
I watch my daughter now, and I'm sure you do this with young teachers, and the way that they go about lesson planning and creating their materials for daily class activities. And then I think back to when I first started teaching, and I'm not going to say how old I think you are, but I was transparency era, right? You know, you made transparencies with grease pens and put that on an overhead projector. And
I'm from that era.
Yeah. And then to watch my daughter and her friends now that are teachers, as they're doing lesson prep, they are in the computer and they are creating, I guess what I would just call stunning infographics and things like that, that they're taking into the classroom that would have, but I don't think, I wouldn't even say it would have taken forever. It just wasn't possible, like when I first started teaching, right? You just couldn't do it. And I think that's really fascinating to watch about how the skills of the teachers are just being augmented in so many ways by some of these technologies, and they're learning to use it really effectively for their students. And I think that's fascinating. Dr. Lawrence, it has been great getting to know you. I don't know if there was anything that I haven't asked you about that you were excited to talk about. If there is, I'd invite you to say that.
Well, I tell you what, I have a busy schedule, but who knows? Maybe we'll invite you down to my podcast, or I'll come down there and be on the set face to face. My public information office team is, I can see them sitting over at the side of the computer. They're smiling and laughing. Yeah. There he goes again, adding something to somebody's schedule. So who knows? Maybe we'll be down there on your podcast live.
Well, I tell you what, I'm actually going to be on sabbatical next academic year, so I will take you up on the invitation to come up to Dayton. I'd love to do that and meet you and the rest of your folks. So we will make that happen.
Thanks a lot.
My guest today has been Dr. David Lawrence. He's the superintendent of schools in Dayton Public Schools. If you would like more information about some of the technologies that David talked about, we will have some links in the text accompanying the podcast, as well as a link to Dayton Public Schools so that you can learn more about them. Thank you for listening to Teaching Matters. I want to give special thanks to April Koska and Trinity Sweet for the work they do behind the scenes to make this podcast work. And of course, we always appreciate the listeners. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope that everyone has a wonderful day.